Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by Dragonmount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series written by Robert Jordan. There are currently 11 novels in the main series as well as one prequel novel.
Sadly, in September of 2007, as he was working on finishing the series, Robert Jordan lost a long and hard-fought battle.
However, despite the loss of its creator, the wheel turns on.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by Dragonmount.com. This episode, we're going to be finishing up our discussion of The Forsaken, or actually our reprise of the discussion of The Forsaken with the new podcast team. And tonight with us, again, we have Andrew Gellos.
Hello, everyone. And also joining us this evening is Jason. How you doing, Jason?
I am doing good. How's everybody else?
Doing fine. Great to have you back. Well, the two Forsaken that we have left are Samael and Semirag. So I think we should start off with Samael. What are your thoughts on good old Samael, the late unlamented Samael?
Samael. Well, Samael is dead.
Yes, he is. Balefired, I believe.
Without a doubt, yeah. He, a lot of people. Actually, let me start with a description of Samael.
Oh, absolutely, because I think he's kind of cute.
He is solid and compact, with a quick stride and abrupt manner. If I could compare him to someone nowadays, I would compare him to a sports star, because that's what he was in the Age of Legends, as a matter of fact.
I always liked Ben's little description that they used to use in the intro. I think Samael was pretty buff. I imagine he probably was.
Definitely. Although, like a lot of the other Forsaken, horribly mentally unstable. We mentioned him a little bit when we were talking about Belal earlier, and Samael, pretty attractive. I mean, a fairly attractive man, but ended up taking a pretty serious wound from Luce Thuren, in which he has a livid groove that looks like someone took a red hot poker and drug it from his hairline down to his jaw. This giant scar over his face. And in the Age of Legends, the thing was perfectly, perfectly capable of being whisked away completely by the One Power. And he absolutely refused. Said it just, you know, it was one of those things that he wanted to keep as a reminder of how much he absolutely hated Luce Thuren. And it was one of the interesting things, I think, about his appearance.
Yeah, that's got to be pretty demented, wanting to keep a scar as a badge of dishonor in a way like that. I can't imagine carrying a grudge to that extent, but then I've never really thought of myself as quite as imbalanced as most of the Forsaken are.
When I think of Samael, you know, and if you think about the big picture in out of all the 13 Forsaken, Samael's probably the number two most, oh, I'm sorry, the number three, behind only Asmodean and Lanfear, as being the most central to the story of the Wheel of Time. Lanfear, of course, she's mentioned probably more, Asmodean in the later books before he dies. And then Samael is, I think he's probably the third most dedicated in the books, and the one that we know the most about, behind Lanfear and Asmodean.
I kind of have to disagree with you a little there, Jason. I really think you got to include Ishamiel, now Moradin, in that list, because he was so central to the first, I think, three books, and now as Nablus, he's got to be considered a key character. But I do have to agree with you, Samael was pretty important, and he appeared a lot.
it would be interesting to find out how much page and word time Samael gets compared to the others. Because, Shamael certainly does get, he's probably the most central to the story, but I don't think he has as much page or word time as Samael does.
Probably not. Samael was certainly one of the more proactive in advancing plots against Lutheran or the other Forsaken or whatever with his... he always seemed to have something going, you know, his dispersing the Shido, all of his things that he had going on with Savannah and the Shido, and then he had his other little schemes that with Grendel and Masana and so forth. He was just always doing something.
Yeah, it's quite true. And on top of that, he ruled Ilion. I mean, he took over an entire country, essentially, and it took a lot. I mean, it took not only Rand, but a number of other, you know, Ashaman and the Legion to oust him finally. And, you know, even then, it really took his death to kind of cinch everything for Rand.
And, you know, one of my favorite storylines in the whole thing is Samael's and Rand's fight to the death. It's by far one of the most action-packed storylines once they start fighting, and by the end when eventually Samael is killed, and he isn't killed by Balefire, he's actually killed by, the name escapes me.
Mashadar.
Yes, that's it. Oh, I'm so bad with names. But yes, he's killed by Mashadar. That's one of my favorite parts in the whole book series.
And it's interesting, too, that at the end of that, well, actually during the middle of that battle, is when Rand first encounters Moradin, or at least we believe it's Moradin, the traveler, who actually rescues him from a very touchy situation and encourages him to finish Samael off.
Very true.
It's also in that scene that we get another tragic notch in Rand's mental list of women he feels responsible for killing, which by the end of the series is such a sizable list because he has that compulsion of mentally burning all of their faces into, you know, his mind. And there was the one maiden of the spear who was accidentally left behind in Shadar Lagoth, and you know it's Rand's realizing that Mashadar had her that kept him from balefiring Samael in the first place.
That's right. I misspoke earlier when I said Samael was balefired. Actually, he balefired Lyya, the maiden, to save her from Mashadar. And then there was actually some confusion in my mind at the end of that scene because he didn't actually see Samael be overwhelmed by Mashadar, which was sort of coming down on him from the balcony above, as I remember. But according to, I believe Robert Jordan said in an interview, that Samael actually was dead and had died the final death and wasn't coming back. But I couldn't tell you where that was said.
His quote is, "Samael is toast."
That's the one I remember exactly. Thank you. Samael is toast.
I don't wonder a little bit if, because we know, or we presume Moradin was around, we're presuming Moradin is the traveler, I don't wonder if maybe seeing Rand hesitate and, you know, and use the balefire to save the maiden, I don't wonder if maybe Moradin did the job for him.
He didn't seem like he was willing to do that, and he encouraged Rand with saying, you know, you've shown you can think like him if you try, and I don't know, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure how much he would have been allowed to do that, although it seems to change almost chapter by chapter with whether or not Moradin wants Randall Thor dead or wants him not to be touched. It's very confusing to me what his actual goals and plans are. I'm not sure sometimes even he knows for sure.
Yeah, that's, I don't know. It just occurs to me that when we first meet him as the traveler, if indeed that is him, and I'm assuming it is because he channels Balefire earlier and Rand doesn't feel anything, which is creepy, which I have to assume is the use of the true power instead of the one power. So we know it can be done without Rand knowing, and I'm not wondering if maybe Moradin rose in the rank as Nameless because he had the gumption to actually do what none of the others had, and that's just outright murder one of their own.
That's an interesting theory. I certainly the Dark One seems to delight in setting his adherents against one another to see who is the most powerful. He likes to see the Chosen compete in that fashion, and in that respect it puts me in mind of the Shanshan Empress, who is obviously no longer going to live forever because she's also toast. But it's very possible that that could have caused him to rise in favor.
Yeah, well, the Empress isn't so much toast as she's jam.
As she's what?
Jam, you know, spread it on toast.
Oh, I like that.
So, final thoughts on Samael.
Well, since he's not coming back as anyone else, I suppose there's not too much left to be said for him. I think the only other thing that I could think of to say is that I thought he was one of the most creative of the of this Forsaken. In his plots, seemed to be some of the more devious. You know, I liked the way he sent the messenger to Rand. You know, the fellow who died on the floor in a welter of blood, to try and give him a message that there'd be no conflict. And he's playing all these sides against each other. I thought that was, except for possibly, I don't even know, except for possibly Morden. I think he probably had more plots in play than almost any of them.
I just have to say I was also amused in a scene with him, or it wasn't with him necessarily, but Grandel was talking about how He was definitely attractive enough to be one of her pretties if she could just convince him to let Samarog fix his face.
And so many other things he had going on with Grendel and Masana, all these other plots he had going. He was kind of interesting. I was sort of sorry to see him go in a way.
Yeah, I think I really could have dealt with seeing him. I mean, primarily because he was also supposed to be not just this sports star, but, I mean, a really expert swordsman, and it would have been really neat to have seen the variations, to have actually seen maybe a little more action from him where it didn't actually focus on Rand. I don't know. It would have been neat to have just seen how good he was, really, because it would have been just something neat, a little side treat, but who knows.
Yeah, I agree. And the other thing that I will kind of miss, some of my favorite Forsaken scenes were those involving his interaction with Grendel in their various different plots and machinations, especially when he was working with her to try and dupe the Shido into doing his bidding. Just their chat back and forth and the way they dealt with each other and their insights into each other I found to be entertaining as well as illuminating, and I think I'm going to miss Samael for that as much as anything, even though I love that description that Grendel thought about him, that he was a hot shofar with warped steering planes or something. It was pretty funny.
All right, so moving on. The next on our list is Samarog.
Ah, Samarog. Everyone fears Samarog.
Samarog, who is taller than most men. She's has a smooth, dark face, dark eyes, long, slender fingers. She's has a charcoal black face and is beautiful. Short, wavy hair. That's the physical description.
Yes, and somebody thought, I think it might have been Grendel, who suggested that she, well, maybe that was Grendel. No, Grendel wore black so often because Lanfear wore white. But Samarog has been most recently spending time in Shandar, as the two-speaker to the Empress herself, and of course is most recently done in the Empress and the entire imperial family, with the exception of Tuan. So now she's back, and she's obviously playing a major part in the last book, in The Knife of Dreams, where she did a horrendous injury to our hero Rand, taking off his hand.
And is now subsequently captured.
Yes, I think that's going to be fascinating. I think I might have mentioned that in one of our conversations with Jesse. I think that we're going to have some interesting scenes with Cadsway, Nynaeve, and Semirog, and I believe that they will be able to eke a lot of information, particularly about healing, out of her. And I think Nynaeve in particular is going to drill in on that, you know, with absolute focus, because I suspect that Semirog might be able to heal almost anything, maybe even including death, and I think that could really play a key factor in the last battle and post-Tarmogoyen Wheel of Time matters as time goes on.
And more importantly, I mean, I've always kind of wondered in Knife of Dreams if Semirog's action there was less desperation than it seemed. I mean, this is a person who is so skilled with fixing and harming the human body that I just kind of have to imagine she could have done so much more to Rand in the few moments she had than just lobbing a fireball at him. And we know that the concussive force has done something to his eyes. He is not seeing as well as he used to. And I'm not wondering if it's more than just the simple, his eyes have been very badly flash burned by the explosive fireball essentially right in his face.
Well, it certainly seems that that's a part of the prophecy. Morden has referred to the Fisher King repeatedly, and of course that connects to a lot of our mythology here in the here and now, where the Fisher King has always worked with a bandage around the eyes and a wound in his side. And, you know, it's sort of archetypical of what happens. I kind of think that she didn't do more to him because she was so shocked because her illusion was shattered so abruptly, and I don't think she was expecting to run into anybody that was going to be anywhere close to a match for her. And between Nynaeve, Cadswain, and Olivia, I think that she was pretty surprised, especially with all the Tarangriel that they had, by the whole situation. Maybe it just put her off balance just that little bit, that she just reacted instinctively with the quickest, fastest weave she could.
It's definitely possible, I think. I don't know. It's really just kind of odd. I mean, especially just for one who is so meticulous. And, I mean, I have to say that it's quite possible that of all the Forsaken, Semirog might be the most naturally evil amongst them all.
Yeah.
Just because in the Age of Legends, she was not just a surgeon. I mean, granted, she was the most brilliant, essentially, you know, medic with the, you know, she was the best restorer of her age. But she always, like, she had that sadistic streak where she took, you know, a measure of pain from everyone that she operated on. And, you know, it was one of those things that was in place well before the bore was ever even drilled. And it was just that sheer compulsion for, you know, sadism that was really surprising in her character.
Yeah, I was thinking one of the reasons that she might not have done more damage to Rand is that one of the last things that Morden had said to the Forsaken before that scene was that Althor was his and he was not to be harmed, as I recall. So maybe she did the least damaging thing that she could do to him to try and get out of the situation, because she feared his wrath if she killed him. But I don't know, maybe she... Why didn't she just weave compulsion on him or something? Maybe she just thought that there were too many strong channelers there for something more devious to work on all of them.
I'm not so sure she didn't want to be caught.
Why do you think she would want to be caught? That's an interesting proposition.
All right, so, yeah, Egwene, she didn't want to be caught, but you know what she did, and she did more damage from the inside than she did the outside, and you know, Robert Jordan and the Wheel of Time is all about equals, and, yeah, I think Samarag is going to do more damage inside than she is going to be, than she would do outside.
Anyway, that's an interesting proposition. I find it hard to imagine that Samarag would have gone to all that trouble to try and get herself captured when she seemed to have an entire other plot in play there, and obviously had some intent of possibly capturing Rand. She was obviously ready not only with the one copy of the mail item, but several of them in case that he had some Ashaman with him. So I don't know. It's certainly possible that she's devious enough to do that. She might have had more than one plot in play, as far as we know. So some of the plots that Samarag had, she set. She had something to do with Cabriana, who was the person that launched off Halima into Saladar as the excuse to be there. She had the whole thing going with the Empress. She had something going on with Suroth to become Empress after she killed the Empress. We don't know what else she really had going on, but I'm sure she had a number of plots in play.
Yeah, because to me, I think that Samarag should have known the posse that Rand would bring with him, and it seems like she was a little underprepared for the whole situation.
I'm not quite sure why she would want to be captured, but obviously I'm not nearly as devious as the Chosen.
Well, I think part of it, they've mentioned in a number of places that that there are a number of different prophecies. You know, we've seen a whole bunch of them. We've seen a number of men's viewings which have said that, you know, Rand was going to be pretty badly wounded. There's allusions, I think even in the first book, to something being wrong with his eyes and something, you know, or at least some allusion to him losing the hand in the 11th book. So I'm not wondering if the Forsaken, if the people on the other side of the coin, the Dark Friends, might not have their own access to these sorts of clues in that. And Samarag might have felt that these things needed to happen. You know, Rand needed to be primed for the last battle in order for Tarmon Gaiden to be ushered in.
You know, that's a very good point, and I didn't think of it in that way. To me, you know, when I'm reading that chapter specifically, it seems like I said, it seems like she should have known better than, she should have known, like, what Rand was going to bring to her. So maybe she didn't want to be captured, but she knew she had to do something, because there's always plans within plans. And I mean, if I was in Samarag's place, I would know, like, what Rand's going to bring to the table. You know what I mean? And she was way underprepared for the whole situation.
But it's very possible that in her arrogance, she was just overly confident and so disparaging of the people of this day and age that she thought she could just take them out no matter who he brought with him. And that seems pretty much in character for her. She doesn't seem to worry too much about anybody being better than she is.
Point taken. I agree.
Yeah, I just don't know. I just can't imagine what she thought she could accomplish being captured. Surely she doesn't want to turn to the light. I, of course, like I say, I'm not nearly devious enough. Robert Jordan's got it all over me when it comes to plot lines like that. Very possibly she does have something in play. But she certainly had a lot of proxies working for her. I'm pretty convinced that she was the one that was beating Sheriam in Saladar, just because of the way the point of view of the person, or actually Sheriam's perception of the point of view of how the person was beating her, it sounded just like Samarag. And I have no reason to doubt that she's planning to leave her alone. And I I've said this before, I've often wondered if Sheriam isn't one of the ones who was turned by the 13-13 combo, the Dreadlords and the Murdral.
Final thoughts on Semirag, which I haven't mentioned. She may be one of the most mispronounced names in Wheel of Time. It is not Semirhag or Semirhage, Semirag.
That's true. I used to think of it as Semirage or something like that, but now I'm used to Semirag. So I don't know. She's got to be one of the scariest ones of all of them. I think that she would definitely be one to walk your nightmares. And I'm just wondering what some of the other plots that she had in play are going to, how they're going to bear fruit. I mean, she had the whole thing going with the Empress in Shandar, and she was working until she was obviously captured, and until Suroth was killed, she was working trying to make Suroth become Empress. And I'm sure she's still got some things going on with the Shanshan. We just don't know what. And she's obviously appeared to a lot of other people in different guises, so I think we're going to be hearing a lot more from her. But I really think that her biggest part in the last book is going to be as a resource of information for Rand, Nynaeve, Cad Swain, and the forces of the light, because I don't think it's coincidental that Egwene and Elaine and Nynaeve had all that experience in handling somebody with an Idom by capturing Mogedion. I think that's what they're going to do to Semirag. I think they're going to slap an Idom on her, and between all of them, and Cad Swain included, I think Semirag's going to be pretty much telling them whatever they need to know.
I sort of feel like that storyline's a little bit old and stale. I mean, we've already gone through that whole Forsaken, giving information. It seems like a rehashing of something we've already gone through.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things to consider, too, is that Semirag's not as easily cowled as most of the rest of them. I mean, during the War of Power, she was captured, and she scared her jailers into letting her go. I mean, it's definitely going to be a titanic clash of wills between Semirag and Cad Swain. Definitely, in my mind, it's going to take a lot more to get anything, and definitely in a way unlike it was with Mogedion, the information you get from her you can't trust. I mean, they're almost, I mean, I don't know how, I mean, even though the Adam allows to sense a lot of things, I have to believe that just anything that comes out of her is going to have to be looked at six ways from Sunday.
Well, I think you're right about that, but the other reason I don't think it's going to be just a rehash of the previous plot line, you know, our side captures a Forsaken on a leash, I think that Cad Swain's methods, and now because the girls have learned so much more, I mean, they were pretty much babes in the wood when Nynaeve captured Mogedion. They really didn't know how to handle her. And, I mean, we saw that when Egwene came on the scene in Saladar, and, I mean, within 20 seconds, she'd shaken out of Mogedion more different weaves than, and more information that they had in the previous months. So I think that Cad Swain's not a babe in the woods. She's not going to take anything off of Semirag, and I think we're not going to see a lot of give and take. It's just going to be, she's going to probably at least try to just dominate her to the point where she's going to have to give it up. Because one of the other things that I think is that although Cad Swain does have the ageless face and is bound by the oaths, I don't know that she's bound by all of the oaths. I think she may have been released from one or more of them at some point in time, and she may not be under the same directive not to do injury to somebody. And Semirag's not an initiate of the White Tower, so she might be able to rough her up pretty well, mentally and physically, to get what she needs. And believe me, Cad Swain will get what she needs.
I do have to say that amongst the female Forsaken, Semirag is in the top three, and the top three is actually kind of a weird three-way tie between Grandal, Lanfear, and Semirag. I am never able to lock down one that really, really, for me, comes out on top of that particular struggle, because they're each devious and rich in their own specific ways, but definitely, and as horrible as this sounds, I've more than once been listening to various music tracks, including the song One Wing Angel from the video game Final Fantasy VII, and at one point in time I had this weird thing going where I was hearing Semirog instead of the word Sephiroth, which is just amazingly creepy in its own way, because the music still ended up sort of fitting.
That is kind of spooky. I just had a thought occur to me, and I'm not quite sure how this would play out, or if it's even possible, because I haven't given it any thought. It just came into my mind as you were speaking just now, Andrew. And do you think there's any possibility that Tuon could somehow end up handling Semirog? Because she is trained as a Suldam. She can handle Damani. And wouldn't that be a nice turnaround if the truth speaker that she was actually a little bit afraid of should end up being in her charge at some point in time? And then she could basically, she's not under any oaths to do anything. She could take all the revenge she wanted for her family.
That is an amazingly creepy thought. and I mean, it might be possible. This, of course, assumes that we're going to have Tuon make it back to Sandir and then back to the main continent before Carmen Gaiden. There's been some conjecture that she might be absent for at least a good chunk of the last book because of her need to return and actually claim the Imperial throne.
You know, I was just reading, I'm actually in the middle of Knife of Dreams at the moment, and it said a couple of times, I believe it was in, might have been Ferret Kareed's point of view or something like that, that, or possibly Suras. Yes, it was Suras for sure, and maybe the other as well, that when she's being confronted by Semirog and encouraged to work to name herself Empress and get rid of Tuon, that Tuon became Empress the moment her mother died. She doesn't actually have to go back to Shandar. It doesn't say that in the book. And I haven't got to that part yet if it has. I read it before, but I've missed it if it does. So she is actually now the Empress. And because Suroth was thinking that she would have to go back, and if it turned out to be one of her sisters who had ordered the hit on Tuon and Tuon was dead, she'd have to go back and make an apology to the woman who actually... If Tuon died, she'd have to go back and make an apology for the Empress's death to the person who actually ordered the killing, you know, and which is very weird and convoluted. But I don't know that she's going to have to go back, and she does know about her family being killed. We found that out at the end of Knife of Dreams. And if all it takes at this point in time is for her contingent with Matt to hook up with Rand's party to be given possession of Semirog, and they're all obviously coming to where they're going to be together at some point before Tarmon Gaiden. I think that's pretty obvious, particularly since every single party is now making some sort of alliance with the Shanshan. They're all going to be one big party at some point in time, I think.
It's not necessarily the death and the actual claiming, now that I'm thinking about it, that Tuon needs to go back to Sandir for. It is the fact that the country, basically the continent, is in an extreme state of civil war because they don't know that she's still alive. They don't know she's Empress because the rest of the Imperial family's dead. And I think she is going to feel obligated to go back because she needs to restore the proper order by claiming the throne in Shanshan.
That's a good point, but I can't see her just getting on a ship and going and being out of the story for 6 months at a time. I think if that does happen, somehow by aligning with one or more of these parties with Perrin and Matt and Rand, she will avail herself of the Ashaman who know the weave of traveling, or possibly some of the Aes Sedai that do. I still think that she's going to have some interaction with Egwene and the White Tower before she goes back to Shandar, unless she can go back and come back rather quickly. I just can't see her being out of the plot line for that long to go back by ship. But that's just my opinion. But I just think it would be a pretty picture to have Semirog be Tuon's newest Damani. I just think that would be exquisitely ironic and certainly a fitting punishment for Semirog.
All right. Well, Semirog has been discussed for quite a while. Probably, I think, maybe the most that we discussed of Forsaken. Any final thoughts on the Forsaken?
Well, I think we're going to have some new ones coming along. Obviously, a number have been put forward. Mazrim Taim, the chiefest of those. What do you think? Are we going to have the number of 13 rounded out before Tarmon Gaiden with new candidates? Not just recycled Forsaken?
I don't know. I think it's possible. If we do, it's going to need that dramatic reveal of the people who we've been assuming are on our side the entire time. I know a number of people who swear up and down that Varen is going to be amongst the newest Forsaken. I personally hope it's not. I really like Varen, and I like her being for the cause of the light, even if she has some extreme methods that she chooses not to share with everyone.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I would hate to see Varen be a dark friend. She's one of my favorite characters, and I visualize her as more of a sort of super character for the light as her reveal, but that may just be because I want that to be so, not because it actually will be. As far as the new Forsaken, yeah, that's going to be a really scary revelation if some of the people that we think are the good guys turn out to be up-and-coming dreadlords. I mean, a lot of people have put forth Alviarin. I think she's a bit weak at this point in time to be considered for one of the new Forsaken, but, you know, anything's possible. Who else is really strong enough among the characters that we now know? If Sheriam's been turned, perhaps she'll be one. Although she seems to be pretty weak at this point, too.
I know you had also mentioned, Virginia, that you had thought it was possible that Loghain had been turned. And I thought that was an interesting possibility, and that would definitely be a shocker for everyone, because I know we're a lot of people really assume right off the bat that his rise to glory is going to be for the light, and that after the last battle he will possibly be the new Mihail for the Black Tower, or even Tamerlan if that position ever resurfaces out of the dregs of the Age of Legends.
I hope not. That is one of my theories, that Loghain may actually have been turned by the 13 dreadlords channeling through 13 Murdral. I really hope it's not, because I kind of like Loghain, but several of the characters have pointed out, I think Egwene and Elaine among them, that the Black Aja and the Dark Friends might all be people that we like. There's no reason to assume that they wouldn't be perfectly likable just because they're Dark Friends. And it just dawned on me one day that there isn't anything that says that Loghain's power and glory to the future is going to be power and glory for the light. He might easily be attaining his power and glory by being a Dark Friend. And like I said, I hope that's not true. But, yeah, I don't know. There's just somebody close to Rand, or one of the main characters, Matt and Perrin, or possibly Egwene, really, I think, is going to have to be revealed as being turned by the 1313. Because, or basically just a Dark Friend in hiding, if that's not the case. But I've always said that Robert Jordan doesn't put anything, or he didn't put anything into these books casually. Everything means something. And that was brought up just too many times we haven't seen it happen to anybody. I think it's just been brought up too many times. Somebody that we don't suspect has been turned. And there are also, I'm sure, are going to be others that we just don't suspect who have been Dark Friends from the get-go. I'm sure the last book is going to be filled with shockers. I just have no doubt. There are so many plot lines that need to be wrapped up.
So here's a question. We've in our discussion of the many characters throughout the Wheel of Time, we almost always ask of the characters we assume to be on the side of light if they're going to survive the last battle. Do we see any of the Forsaken actually surviving?
Yeah, I think a number of them are going to survive. I don't know in what form they're going to survive, but I can't believe that they'll all be wiped out. That's just my thought. Unless it's a complete and total victory for the light and everything, you know, the Dark One and all of the Dreadlords and all of the Forsaken are just, you know, comprehensively pounded into oblivion. I'm sure some of them are going to survive. And there's been mention made of Lanfear possibly turning back to the light. I think that was that your theory, Andrew, or was it Andrew Miller's theory that Lanfear might come back to the light for the hope of reuniting with Luce Theron, or her inability to kill him at the final confrontation?
I cannot claim credit for that particular crazy theory. That was definitely Andrew Miller's idea.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think if one of the Forsaken were going to return to light, it might possibly be Lanfear. She seems to have more human feelings than most of them, even though she's, you know, very, very selfish and very, very obsessively driven. She does seem to have, well, she loves Luce Theron. I mean, she really does seem to have some feelings for him, aside from her, you know, desire for power and control and everything.
Well, I would definitely say that Lanfear is amongst those that could turn. Of course, the most likely candidate to turn back to the light was Balefire, or we assume, into non-existence. We know he's dead, and we know he's not coming back. And we specifically avoided, in all three of these episodes, really talking about his death, and that was Asmodean.
Yeah, I sort of thought he was the closest to coming to the light, too, especially after he had interacted with Rand for a while, because he seemed to be getting more and more like a person you might actually want to know, rather than a Forsaken. You know who else I think is extremely unlikely to be a dark friend, but for that reason might actually be one, is Egwene's maid that was chosen by Sheriam, who I think might have been turned, our beloved Chessa. That would be a real shocker, would it not? Yeah, right. Chessa was found in Saladar for Egwene when she was raised to the Amyrlin seat, and she was found, she was a gift, she's specifically described as being a gift from Sheriam. Now, the other two maids were, what was her name, Mary and, Salome, they were chosen by Lelaine and Ramonda to spy on her, but because Egwene trusts Sheriam, she trusts Chessa, and Chessa is so likable. You know, she immediately came across as somebody who had been in Egwene's service for ages because she just was so sweet and comfortable and caring. But again, there's no reason to suspect that a dark friend can't be somebody who would be totally likable as part of their guise. So I've had my doubts. It is kind of off the wall, but I don't know. Somebody that we like is going to turn out to be a bad guy. It just has to be so, I think.
I had thought Chessa, though, was one of those, I mean, this once again doesn't exclude your theory at all, but I thought Chessa was one of the ones who's actually served the Amyrlin before. I thought she was a retainer to, if not just Siwan, then like multiple previous Amyrlins.
Nope. No, she was found in Saladar the way Mary and Salome were specifically to be there. I mean, we heard about how the other two were basically found from among the hordes of people that were wandering, you know, because the Dragon Reborn had broken all bounds and everything. The other two were found by Ramonda and Lelaine for Egwene, but the only mention of Chessa is that she was a gift from Sheriam, and it's implied that she was, you know, found the same way. It never makes a mention of her having served any other Aes Sedai or Amyrlin seat whatsoever. The only mention of it that's ever made that's even close to something like that is when Siwan remarks that, are you sure she hasn't been in your service since she was a babe? Because she just is so comfortable with her. But no, I think she just was she was just picked up and given to Egwene to be her maid by Sheriam. And if I'm right about Sheriam, that even doubles the possibility that Chaesa could be a hidden dark friend. I mean, they can't all be as obnoxious as Leandrin, after all, or Tamyla, or Chesmal. Good heavens. They'd all be so obvious.
Yeah, I guess that is pretty true.
I mean, I think some of the most scary characters in movies and fictions have been the actual fairly, you know, good-looking, likable guys who are completely evil. And I'm sort of reminded of, it was a terribly cheesy movie, but I think it was an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. What was it called? The Last Days or something like that. And I think, and I always get his name wrong too. I always think of Gareth Bryn, but his name is Gabriel Byrne, I think it is, or something like that, the actor. And he played basically the devil come back. And I mean, he's very suave and good looking and actually kind of nice, but he's just comprehensively evil. And just thinks nothing of throwing a guy in front of a bus or anything else. It's like, but I mean, if you just came up and met him, you'd think, wow, what a nice guy, you know?
I definitely get your point. The entire, I would expect a servant of evil to appear fair, but somehow feel foul, to misquote my Tolkien.
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking of. Well, you know, yeah, to go into Tolkien, Saruman was sort of like that. I mean, on the surface, anyway, he's very stern and likable, but wise and a little kindly. And, you know, you just don't think of this person as being a servant of the evil, but, that makes them all the more evil. They're just, as you say, they seem fair and they are foul. Maybe that's just too pat for Robert Jordan, but I don't know. There's got to be some bad guys in hiding amongst our heroes' intimates, and I'm at a loss to think of who some of them might be. It's going to be major reveals when this happens in the last book. I mean, I keep thinking of all these people that perhaps we really like, you know, who might turn out to be bad ones. I just don't know. I can't see, honestly, a lot of people have said Alviarin for a new dark dreadlord or Forsaken, but I just think she's too weak and broken now after her experience. She's been marked by the Dark One, but I don't know. She seems like a thin reed to me.
Yeah, I mean, of course, there's also been a few of the dreams and the one Tarangriel where they seemed to imply that Elida might not actually be out to still Egwene eventually for her transgression of acting as Amyrlin, but that it might actually turn out that maybe Elida has been turned by the combination, even though we already aren't supposed to like her, and that she might in turn be trying to eventually get it so that Egwene herself might be turned.
Well, yes, as you mentioned, that was certainly not really foretold, but that certainly appeared in... It wasn't really a dream. I think that was during her test for Accepted, wasn't it? The last ring that she went through. But in a way, that could be a foreshadowing of that happening. And certainly now that she's in the White Tower under Mesaana's thumb, if you will, she's got to be at great risk for that. And the only thing I can hope for is that, you know, she'll be able to... you know, burst out of captivity that way in order to do that. Of course, you know, Egwene has a lot of outs. I mean, there's nothing stopping her from opening a gateway into Teleron Riad. Excuse me. There's nothing stopping her from opening a gateway the next day into Teleron Riad and walking out of there. I mean, she could leave anytime she wants to. I mean, that's how she got from the Waste to Saladar. You know, she just opened up a gateway into the world of dreams. There she goes. So she even made Bella to ride all the way there so she didn't have to walk. So I think that her captivity could end the minute that she thinks something's wrong. The only thing that might make it difficult for her would be the Forkroot tea. But I also wonder if somebody is given Forkroot tea ongoing day after day after day, perhaps they become accustomed to it. You know, like many drugs in our day and age, you know, I mean, if you sit there and take Vicodin every day for 5 years, it's not going to work for you the same way it did the first time. Maybe they can get accustomed to it and she can overcome the effects of it.
That would be something interesting to see. I mean, we definitely know we're going to see more of Egwene, especially as she interacts with Elida in the last book. It'll definitely be interesting to see if maybe that might not be in the works already. You know, we know she tests herself here and there, and we know that Egwene, amongst all of the girls that we've seen in the books, is the one to push herself the most. I mean, more so than Elaine or Nynaeve, she really, really pushes herself to learn absolutely everything. I mean, so we don't know necessarily. She may have stumbled upon that little secret, and it might work out that there are a lot larger shocks and things are in store than people would give credit for.
Yeah, that's really true. And the other thing about Egwene is that she does know all these weaves for inverting her flows and weaving the weave around herself that masks her ability to channel. And so if she does become tolerant of the fork roof enough to where she can start channeling again, she should be able to stay undercover as not being able to channel for as long as she feels it serves her purposes. And then there's absolutely nothing stopping her from breaking out of there at any time she feels like then. And now, even now, I think that if they're only giving it to her during the day and it wears off at night, I suspect that there's some point in time going to be a moment where she'd be able to weave a gateway well enough to just step into the world of dreams in the flesh and leave. And probably no reason she couldn't do the same with Lyanna and get her out of there that way. I think there's going to be a lot of surprises in store for us in that scenario. But as far as I can tell, Egwene's holding all the cards in that particular situation.
Definitely. But with this wonderful Egwene tangent, I think we can safely say that we have really wrapped up our second edition of the discussion on the Forsaken. We've gone through all 13 of the original. We have discussed those coming up, possibly. And those who have passed on and come back to us with new faces. So I definitely think that'll close out this episode of the Fourth Age. Somewhere along the way, even though, much like Samael, we didn't see him go, Jason apparently disappeared, and hopefully, unlike Samael, we will hear from him again very soon.
In his own guise, not as a recycled Jason. So we hope that we'll be seeing him again shortly. I am sure he's not gone for good. Anyway, I would like to issue an invitation to anybody who's listening. If you have thoughts on the Forsaken or something that you can think of that we didn't cover, please give us a call on our voicemail or email us at podcast@dragonmount.com, and we'll be glad to discuss your point of view in an upcoming episode. Even though we've pretty much finished up with the Forsaken, I don't think there's ever a point where everything has been said about them. These characters in the Wheel of Time are so rich and diverse that there's always something more that we might have overlooked, so feel free.
Yes, definitely. And as you mentioned, you can also call in and leave us a voicemail. The number is 1-888-333-7690. You won't actually get to talk to anybody in person, but you can leave us a message. And in that particular way, there is a possibility of getting your own voice on one of the future podcasts.
Yes, we'd love to get some voicemails from you. We'd love to hear from you. We love your emails. And we actually did have a listener feedback episode all ready to go, except that it suffered some technical problems, so we're going to have to redo part of that. But we have taken all of your emails into account, and we've responded to a lot of them, and you'll be hearing that coming up.
You can also, of course, leave us messages on the forums.
www.dragonmount.com/podcast with a capital P. Also, you can find the links off of the homepage. And each podcast has its own place on the blog. They're all separated by months and then by podcast within that month.
And of course, we also have our MySpace page. Our good friend and fellow podcaster Morgan is keeping up with that on a very consistent basis and definitely updating its blog as we update ours. It should also be noted that I'm not 100% on this, but I do believe you can still contact us using the audio feature through the MySpace page, and the address for that is www.myspace.com/fourthage.
I'm not sure about the audio. I believe Carrie said that was disabled, but you can definitely contact us through the MySpace page, and if you can't use the audio, you can always call in and do the voicemail. Or if you wish, if you have access to a microphone and Audacity or something else to record, you can always record your thoughts and views and save it as an MP3 and just email that to us.
Definitely, but we take absolutely everything. We take listener feedback of all sorts, be it congratulations, be it crazy theories, be it criticisms or suggestions on how we can make the podcast better. We definitely listen to or read absolutely everything that comes to us, and it all goes into the show in one form or another.
And so I think that about wraps up this episode. We really want to thank everyone for listening and hanging in there with us. And for myself, I hope that the light will illumine you.
And for myself and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Serapianinto Manshima Tai Shite. Thank you.